Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 28th of January, these are our main stories. At least seven Israelis have been shot and killed at a synagogue in East Jerusalem. Police say they killed the attacker. As the video is broadcast of a brutal attack by five black police officers on a black motorist who later died, we hear from the victim's mother.
No mother should go through what I'm going through right now. To lose their child to the violent way that I lost my child.
As the world remembers Holocaust Memorial Day, we hear about disturbing levels of denial.
17% of the Holocaust content on TikTok is now denying the Holocaust or is distorting it.
Also in this podcast, the head of the UN Refugee Agency says Russia's program of mass adoption of Ukrainian children is a violation of child protection principles. And
هنا لندن القسم العربي بهيئة الإذاعة البريطانية هنا لندن BBC.
BBC Arabic Radio ends transmission after 85 years. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has visited the scene of an attack on a synagogue in East Jerusalem where at least seven people have died. A number of others are thought to have been injured. It comes amid an escalation in tensions this week following an Israeli military raid in Jenin in the occupied West Bank. Let's get the latest on this evolving story now. The BBC's Yola Nel spoke to me from Jerusalem.
Well, this shooting happened at the start of the Jewish Sabbath. It was at a synagogue in this Israeli settlement in East Jerusalem, Neve Yaakov. What it looks like is the gunman was waiting for worshippers to come out after prayers when he opened fire. Afterwards, he tried to escape in a car but was pursued by police who ultimately shot him dead. There were some Israeli witnesses who told the BBC they heard several shots at that point. They heard a shout of Allahu Akbar, God is great in Arabic. And you could see on TV footage, there were emergency workers at the scene. They were really treating a lot of people that were lying in the road. In the local media, Israeli and Palestinian, they're identifying this gunman as being from East Jerusalem. So that would be close to where the attack happened. They're saying that he's a lone wolf attacker. That's the assumption at the moment. Certainly, although we've had praise from Hamas and Islamic Jihad militant groups who are connecting this to what happened in Jenin a day ago when nine Palestinians were killed in an Israeli military raid, they're not also saying that this was one of their members. But we've had this kind of flare-up in the last 24 hours because that Jenin attack was also followed by militants firing six rockets from Gaza at southern Israel last night, Israeli warplanes then bombing militant sites there. What we've seen just since this deadly synagogue shooting is that in Jenin and in the Gaza Strip, there have been some celebrations, at least sweets have been given out as a celebration of what's happened.
And what about the response from the Israeli authorities?
Well, very quickly, despite it being the Jewish Sabbath, we saw the Israeli National Security Minister, the far-right Itamar Ben-Gvir, heading to the scene, trying to reassure people. Also, that the Prime Minister there, we've had the US condemning what said was an apparent terrorist attack, the UN saying it's deeply worried by an escalation of violence and urging utmost restraint.
Yola Nel in Jerusalem. Now to the US. On the 7th of January, 29-year-old Tyree Nichols from Memphis in Tennessee had been taking photographs of the sunset when he was stopped by police for alleged reckless driving. What happened next escalated into a brutal attack and 3 days later, the death of the young black man. On Thursday, five black police officers were charged with second-degree murder. At a news conference on Friday, attended by Tyree Nichols' family, the lawyer Ben Crump said America would be shocked by video footage, which, as we record this podcast, is due to be released.
His last words on this earth is, Mom, Mom, Mom. I mean, he's screaming for, he said, I just want to go home. I mean, it's a traffic stop, for God's sake.
Tyree Nichols' mother, Rovon Wells, said the five officers had brought shame upon their families.
No mother, no mother, no mother should go through what I'm going through right now, to lose their child to the violent way that I lost my child.
Our correspondent, Barbara Plett-Usher, who's in Memphis, told Rebecca Kesby about the case.
Well, what's been reported is that there was an allegation of reckless driving, but I was just speaking to his mother now, and she has been saying that she was told different things by police, that when they came to her door, they told her that they'd stopped him for drunk driving and that he'd been tased and needed to be helped by paramedics, so he was going to be in hospital. And then a few days later, that she got a call that he was having a cardiac arrest and she needed to come immediately. And so she feels that she was misinformed about what happened, and she said when she walked in and saw her son, and she said his head was swollen, his neck was broken, it was pretty clear that he'd been in a very dire situation for quite a long time. And I asked her why she said that she's not going to watch the video or hasn't been able to watch it. And she said, well, when I saw him, I knew why would I need to watch it again. The officials themselves have been quite circumspect about it. They've said there was a confrontation, then Mr. Nichols ran, and then there was another confrontation. But they have also been very clear that the video evidence of what happened is pretty brutal.
What are the authorities saying that they anticipate in the coming hours and days after this video is released?
They are urging people to express their anger in a peaceful way, but not to move beyond that. And I think have acted fairly quickly to try to prevent that from happening. They've delayed the release of the video until the charges were laid, hoping that that would cause people to be more peaceful in the way that they protest when they see the images.
Barbara Plett-Usher talking to Rebecca Kesby. When Soviet troops approached the Auschwitz-Birkenau Nazi concentration camp 78 years ago, they had no idea the place existed and what atrocities had occurred there. But today, despite Russian liberation of the camp, no representative of that country was invited to the Holocaust Memorial Day service. Holocaust survivors and international leaders honoured those who've died in commemoration ceremonies held around the world. Our religion editor, Ali Makbul, reports.
78 years ago today, at the Auschwitz-Birkenau Nazi death camp in southern Poland, Soviet Red Army troops liberated the thousands of remaining prisoners. It's become the day the 6 million Jewish men, women and children, and also those of other groups, killed in the Holocaust are commemorated. 83-year-old survivor Joan Salter said it was a moment to reflect on the fact it was ordinary people that perpetrated the atrocities.
The ability to turn people against each other is unbelievable. Through mass hysteria and dehumanizing people and blaming people for all the problems that were going on, the hyperinflation, it led to the camps.
At the remembrance event at the German parliament, there was condemnation of a recent increase in anti-Semitism across the country, where memorial sites have been desecrated. And there was also a focus on the murder of LGBT people by the Nazis. Adonai Shema V'Koli. At Auschwitz itself, for the first time, no Russians were invited to the commemorations. In fact, the director of the Auschwitz Museum likened Russia's aggression in Ukraine to the horrors of the Holocaust.
Dziś nazywają się Bucha, Irpień, Hostomel, Mariupol i Donetsk.
For his part, Vladimir Putin used the anniversary to repeat claims that have been condemned internationally, including by Holocaust survivors, that ethnic Russians were being cleansed from Ukraine by neo-Nazis.
Ali Makbul. As the years roll on and the number of Holocaust survivors dwindles, there's concern that misinformation is spreading. A new series of surveys examining Holocaust awareness in Europe and North America has revealed growing levels of ignorance. In one of the most striking statistics, nearly a quarter of young Dutch adults think the Holocaust is a myth or the number of Jews killed has been greatly exaggerated. Alan Marcus is a fellow at the Holocaust Institute for Teacher Education in the US. And James Kumarasamy asked him what he made of this striking statistic from the Netherlands.
It's quite scary, actually, and the numbers are similar in the United States and in other European countries. The Center for Holocaust Education at University College London did a recent study, and they spoke with teachers, and one in four teachers reported that they were encountering anti-Semitism from their students. And one in six teachers said that they had students who were denying the Holocaust. So these numbers are pretty scary. And, you know, I don't think there's a lot that's changing with what teachers are doing, but there's a lot that's changed with the environment in which students are and people in general are getting their information outside of school.
What would you point to?
One is the mainstreaming of anti-Semitism, whether it's musician Kanye West or in the United States, members of Congress from both parties that are posting anti-Semitic tropes, this idea that anti-Semitism has become normal. So that's allowed hardcore deniers. It used to be it was David Irving and it was just he could write his books, but now that's leaking into the mainstream. And so I think that's influencing what students and what adults are hearing. Young people are on TikTok. And 17% of the Holocaust content on TikTok is now denying the Holocaust or is distorting it. This is coming from the Anti-Defamation League in the U.S. 20% of Holocaust information on Twitter is denying or distorting it. So I think really what's happened is we've lost control of the truth.
Alan Marcus speaking there to James Kumarasamy. Disability activists in South Korea are being sued by Seoul's subway authority for causing major disruption during the morning rush hour. Solidarity Against Disability Discrimination says it wants all stations to be wheelchair accessible and more funding to be allocated to disability provisions in the national budget. But the authority's hardline response has led to a bitter feud and clashes between demonstrators and security forces. Nick Marsh reports from Seoul.
Deep underground in Seoul, there's a battle happening at rush hour. For the past year, disabled South Koreans have been protesting on subway platforms. They're tired of being unable to access parts of the system, so they routinely block train doors, crawl through carriages, and hold up key services. "We are citizens too," they shout. Most are over the age of 60. But when the authorities step in, things get ugly. Videos of riot police clashing with protesters and of security forces manhandling elderly wheelchair users have made headlines in South Korea.
"I've been hit by commuters. I've been followed home. People shout at us. They say, 'Why don't you stay at home?'"
Lee Hyun-suk is one of the demonstrators. She's been using a wheelchair since developing polio when she was 3.
"The gap between disabled and non-disabled people here is so huge that we have to continue."
Seoul's mayor has already vowed zero tolerance when it comes to the protests. And on the platform, sympathy appears to be in short supply.
"I was 1 hour late for my hospital appointment because of this. Why do they have to cause harm to innocent citizens?"
"Look at all this. How many facilities the disabled already have. I agree with the police."
The people here say they want to be able to get around their own city just like everybody else. But the way that they've gone about it hasn't exactly won them many friends from commuters. Then again, neither has the response from the authorities. It's been pretty quiet here this morning, and yet the people here have been outnumbered by police and riot police by about 5-1. It's not a great look.
The government says it's already more than doubled spending on mobility provisions, and those who run Seoul Metro are currently suing the protesters for the equivalent of $500,000.
"안녕하세요. Hello, Nick."
This is about more than numbers, though. Ji Min is 17. She's been using a wheelchair since recovering from cancer as a toddler.
"In South Korean society right now, you don't see disabled people enough. Our life has always been stuck at home, giving up on going places even if you want to go somewhere. We want to show the world that we exist."
Her mother, Yun Hui, helps her design interactive maps showing where disabled people can and can't go in Seoul. They're working hard to change attitudes, but they fear that the protests will be used to villainize disabled people. Those in charge have already said that they harm ordinary South Koreans. But those protesting say ordinary South Koreans is exactly what they are.
Nick Marsh. 11 months after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the authorities there say thousands of the country's children have been deported to Russia, and Kyiv has accused the Kremlin of kidnapping them. Now, the head of the UN refugee agency, Filippo Grandi, has been speaking about the issue at the end of a six-day visit to Ukraine. So, what's he been saying? Our Europe regional editor is Danny Eberhard.
One of the main things he's talked about is that what Russia is doing with some unaccompanied children is breaching fundamental principles of child protection. He's talked about the issue of some children being given Russian passports, and also some have also been adopted. Now, this is something that Ukraine has picked up on. They've accused Russia of abducting and forcibly deporting thousands of Ukrainian children from occupied areas. The number they give is 14,000. But this issue is extremely complicated because Russia doesn't give figures. And the UNHCR, which Filippo Grandi is the head of, also doesn't have verifiable data. So really, it's a very confusing picture. We know that Russia isn't respecting international conventions, but we don't know the scale of the problem. And Filippo Grandi didn't himself say anything on that issue. Now, Russia says that the children that have come out of Ukraine have not been kidnapped, that they have been evacuated voluntarily, and it's actually saving the children, and it's putting children with families in different regions of Russia. Now, some of these adoptions are in areas that Ukraine says are geographically hugely distant from Ukraine, and sometimes also culturally very distinct, areas like Dagestan. But what Ukraine demands is that all children be sent back to Ukraine to be reunited either with their parents or, if they're orphans, with close relations. And according to international humanitarian law, that is what should happen.
Danny Eberhard. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
Pinocchio changed character with the H animator. They spend days in a little room. They see the puppets every day. Some animators went into a scene or a set and didn't leave for more than 2 years.
The award-winning director Guillermo del Toro tells us about his latest Oscar-nominated film, Pinocchio. After 85 years, BBC Arabic Radio, the first foreign language service broadcast by the corporation, has gone off air. It first went out on the 3rd of January 1938 in response to the Italian leader Benito Mussolini's propaganda and the rise of fascism in Europe. Since then, it's covered decades of wars and crises in the Middle East, including the Suez Crisis of 1956, the numerous Arab-Israeli wars, Palestinian uprisings, the invasion of Iraq, and the widespread protests in the region in 2011. Sebastian Usher, our Middle East reporter, told us more.
Well, at the time, it wasn't the British World Service, it was the British Empire Service, and it was to speak to a wider audience in the Arabic world was seen as a very significant audience 85 years ago. The rise of Nazism, the rise of fascism in Europe. And part of it was an effort to counter the narrative, the news that was being put out from that side with the British, the Western version of events. But also an imperative, the BBC ethos, to present as objective and as reliable information as possible to its audience. And that's where the strength grew and why generations of Arab speakers, both in the Middle East but outside too, grew to depend and to love the service, because it was at a time when in the Arab world it was very difficult to get independent information, information that wasn't censored. So it was a lifeline in terms of news. I can think of friends of mine in Lebanon during the Civil War who have spoken to me about it and say that they relied on listening to the BBC, not just for news about what was going on, but actually to know if it was safe to venture outside.
And of course, seismic times. I mean, broadcasting over 8.5 decades and so many things happened. Arab-Israeli wars, Palestinian uprisings, the invasion of Iraq. I mean, history in the making.
Absolutely. As I say, through much of that time, the BBC radio was the paramount source of international information for Arab speakers on all of those tumultuous events. It was the source. And those generations who were listening then, their children, I mean, those are the ones who were most affected by the fact that BBC Arabic Radio has actually stopped broadcasting. Many of them have been saying they were listening with tears in their eyes to the last broadcast.
So what will happen now?
You'll no longer be able to switch on a particular wavelength, the Arabic radio, and it won't be a continuous service as it's been. But a lot of the programming you will be able to get online. The aim is to keep up with the times, this move towards digital, which is not just Arabic radio, but many other parts of the BBC are also doing that, and also to make cuts. But for many people, it's just such a symbol of their own past. It's a symbol of what the Arab world has been, and it's a symbol of what the BBC has meant in that region. And that's what they're mourning today, that loss, even if in reality it's not an end, but it's seen as an end of that era.
Sebastian Usher. Here in the UK, six members of a gang have been jailed for child trafficking after police treated as a victim a 14-year-old boy who was caught dealing drugs. The teenager, arrested in Wales almost 2 years ago, refused to cooperate with detectives, but evidence on phones, including that of a serving prisoner, exposed the way he'd been exploited. The case is the biggest of its kind and has been hailed as a model for dismantling gangs that use children to sell drugs. Our social affairs correspondent, Michael Buchanan, has been investigating the story.
OK, police!
Graham Jones may have feared being arrested for drug dealing, but not child abuse.
I'm going to arrest you on suspicion of modern-day slavery offences.
Modern-day slavery?
Yeah. Child trafficking.
His detention was the result of an unusual police operation. In February 2021, a 14-year-old boy was arrested in Rhyl in North Wales, with around £2,500 worth of heroin and crack cocaine on him after selling drugs to an undercover police officer. But instead of charging him, police decided to treat him as a victim of child trafficking after seizing his phones and those of others they detained. Having advertised his willingness to engage in criminality on social media, officers discovered the boy was soon texting someone called Main Man. Main Man was Wesley Hankin, an inmate at Portland Prison in Dorset, more than 200 miles away. He was serving a prison sentence for drugs offences and directing the teenager using phones he'd smuggled into his cell. Over a two-week period, officers discovered that the boy, who'd run away from a care home, had been moved around England and Wales, staying in drug-dealing homes in Wigan at one point, for instance. He filmed himself with a large serrated knife, a cosh, hundreds of pounds in cash and dozens of wraps of Class A drugs. Detective Superintendent Simon Williams from North Wales Police defended the decision to treat the boy as a victim.
I think we see him as a child, really, 14-year-old child. He was having to hold on to a weapon for his own protection. He was probably at more risk than he understood himself. In my eyes, certainly a victim, not a perpetrator.
Six people, five men and a woman, were each given sentences of up to 7 years and 4 months for trafficking a child. Wesley Hankin was given a 10-year prison sentence for drugs offences, as police couldn't prove he knew his foot soldier was a child. The police say they hope the boy, who is now 16, will in time appreciate what they've done for him, and that drug dealers will fear being convicted of child abuse.
Michael Buchanan. Several African countries have recently been visited by top envoys, from China's foreign minister, Qin Gang, to the US Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, and the US ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, as well as the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, not to mention many lower-level officials. So, why the rush to Africa? Bola Masuro asked Pauline Bax, an Africa expert at the International Crisis Group.
I think what we see is a bit of a scramble by the US, for sure. The US has announced a new comprehensive Africa strategy about 6 months ago. And there was, of course, the summit with President Joe Biden in Washington last month, where he tried to strengthen ties with African leaders. And that, I think, is a reaction to a strong sense that the US has neglected Africa for many years, especially under the Trump administration, which was quite dismissive of Africa as a whole, as we know. And then meanwhile, Russia is trying to revive its ties with some African countries because it needs friends on the world stage.
The reason why some people talk about this scramble for Africa, especially when talking about the United States and China and other nations too, is this desire for control of resources, more of an economic hold in some of those countries. And that's why a number of people have said that Africa should look more within itself than look to all these other countries outside of the continent that are trying to get control.
The word control here, I'm not sure if that's appropriate, because I think we should keep in mind that most African nations know very well how to play this game. They're just trying to extract the best they can from all these powers that come to visit them while not aligning themselves explicitly with any of them.
Yes, I think it's more neo-colonialism that people see this as economic ties mirroring what used to happen in the 19th century.
Well, of course, I mean, Africa has green metals and all kinds of mining assets that are important for all these powers. And they will be more important in years to come when more people get electric vehicles whose base metals come from Africa. But if you mentioned China, right? And I think it's really important to stress that China has been on top for years in Africa. It's the continent's biggest trade partner by far. You know, it dwarfs the US, it completely dwarfs Russia in that sense. And it has done very pragmatic and clever soft power diplomacy that
Indeed.
Has worked very well.
Pauline Bax speaking to Bola Masuro. The world of fairy tales can be dark. Think of children being abandoned in the woods or eaten by wolves. Pinocchio is no exception. The original version is far more sinister than the Disney cartoon, which became so famous. Well, now the story of Pinocchio, the puppet whose nose grows when he lies, has been retold once again, this time in animation by the acclaimed film director Guillermo del Toro, who's just been nominated for both an Oscar and three BAFTAs. In his first full-length interview since being nominated, Guillermo del Toro, with his co-director Mark Gustafson, spoke to Martha Carney, who asked whether we get a sense of the puppets really coming to life.
Yeah. You live with these characters for years. You know them intimately.
How would you describe their characters?
Geppetto's a good actor.
He's a very good actor. You don't always get a beautiful puppet to animate, but these just so happened to come out so we could get really, really great performances out of them. The animators really enjoyed working with them.
Pinocchio changed character with each animator.
You are talking about them as if they were real characters, mm-hmm. but can you get the same kind of subtlety as you would with a real-life actor?
I think so. We basically distill human emotion to gestures that are either dictated minutely by Mark and I, or they are found by the animator in a contact with the puppet that is unlike any other form of animation. They spend days and days in a little room. They see the puppets every day. Some animators went into a scene or a set and didn't leave for more than 2 years.
2 years.
2 years.
Yeah, when you shoot for 1,000 days, one of the benefits of that is that the animators really get to know the characters and you can go deeper with them.
Now, Guillermo, I wanted to go back to what started this whole project, and I think it was partly to do with drinks you had with the very famous novelist, Gabriel García Márquez.
Yeah, no, I already was talking to him about this, and he said, Pinocchio can be adapted as many times as needed because it's a symbol. It's one of the very few characters that changes. You can put him in the future. You can use him as a metaphor for politics, family, innocence. And it was very encouraging to hear that he said there is no end to characters like this. And he said there's only a handful.
And that's what captured your imagination. So tell me a bit more about what you think Pinocchio symbolizes.
To us, in this tale, I think that he happens to be a very pure essence that transforms the world around him and doesn't budge to pressure. It doesn't conform. The only lie he will not say is a lie about who he is. So it's truthful about who he is. And that changes the environment in a moment in history where everybody wants to obey. And there's a totalitarian idea of obedience as a virtue.
And this totalitarian idea is quite a strong theme in the film, isn't it? It's set against the background of fascism in Italy.
That's partially why we chose to do it with puppets, because it was very moving to have a story about people that swear they are not puppets, but they are puppets, physically animated.
Part of a puppet regime.
Part of a puppet regime. And the only puppet that doesn't behave like a puppet is the puppet, which is Pinocchio.
Do you think that theme of totalitarianism, is that something that worries you about modern Europe?
Absolutely, about the world. Because totalitarian thought is not just circumscribed to politics. It can be peer pressure and to conform. And that's why I think disobedience and choice, both are the seats of the soul. You are operating on choice every single moment of the day. And we pretend that only the big choices count. That's why it's beautiful on Pinocchio. You have a father telling a bedtime story to a kid about always telling the truth, but he's willing to live under a totalitarian system that is full of lies and a pretend father figure on the top of it. This anomaly, Pinocchio, will not lie about himself, but everybody else that says don't lie is lying to themselves.
Guillermo del Toro and Mark Gustafson, and Pinocchio is available on Netflix now. And finally, the British singer Rick Astley is suing an American rapper for using an impersonation of his voice. Lawyers for Mr. Astley claim that Young Gravy's track Betty Get Money mimicked his vocals from his 1987 hit Never Gonna Give You Up. Our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson has been listening to both songs. Never gonna give you up, never
gonna let you down. This is Rick Astley. His 1987 debut single reached number one in 25 countries. This is Nick Seeley, known professionally as Pop Nick, singing on Betty Get Money by the rapper Young Gravy. The single sold more than 500,000 copies in the US last year. Now Rick Astley wants to get money from Betty Get Money. He has filed a multi-million dollar lawsuit in Los Angeles, saying that the use of an imitation of his voice was not authorised. The original version was written by the British songwriting team Stock, Aitken & Waterman. The lawsuit states that only the instrumental parts of the song were licensed, not Rick Astley's voice, and that Young Gravy had conspired to include a deliberate and nearly indistinguishable imitation. Vocal impressions have been part of the music business for decades. In 1986, Nick Kamen famously peeled off his Levi 501s in a laundrette to the sound of I Heard It Through the Grapevine by Marvin Gaye. Except it wasn't Marvin Gaye, but a newly recorded version by a sound-alike session singer used because it was exponentially cheaper. And when Bette Midler refused to let the Ford Motor Company use her version of Do You Wanna Dance in a car advert, an impersonator was brought in to do the job. Do you wanna dance? A US Court of Appeal ruled that the advertising agency involved had to pay her $400,000 because a voice was as distinctive and personal as a face. Now Rick Astley unexpectedly finds himself in a rap battle. One which, of course, he is never going to give up.
Colin Patterson. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Julian Farmer. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.